time once again for Community Forum. And we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese. Margaret Flowers is a contributor at PopularResistance.org, co-director of It's Our Economy, and is a Maryland pediatrician. After graduation from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in 1990 and completion of pediatric residency at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, she worked first as a hospitalist and then in private practice. She left practice in 2007 to advocate full-time for single-payer healthcare system at both the state and national levels. And she is host of the Clearing the Fog radio show, along with Kevin Zeese. Kevin Zeese is a contributor also at PopularResistance.org, co-director of It's Our Economy, and an attorney who has been a political activist since graduating from George Washington Law School in 1980. He works on peace, economic justice, criminal law reform, and reviving American democracy. And he serves as president of Common Sense for Drug Policy and is a co-founder of the Drug Policy Foundation, now known as Drug Policy Alliance. Margaret and Kevin, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you for having us, Mike.
So start out, tell us a bit about Popular Resistance. How did that come about?
Sure. PopularResistance.org is a project that came out of our work organizing the occupation in Washington, D.C. back in the fall of 2011. And basically, it's a website that covers the movement, resistance that's going on across the United States that a lot of people aren't aware of because the commercial media doesn't talk about it. But on a whole range of issues, people are standing up and fighting back. And we, in addition to lifting that up, want to show work that people are doing to create alternative solutions, like alternative economies, renewable energy things, and show that all of our movements are connected, that we, you know, we have the root causes are the same for all of the issues that we're fighting on. And we look for ways that we can work together to actually create some change and shift power to the people. A unique concept in the United States.
Yeah, when Occupy, we saw Occupy as a tactic, being in the public space to get some of the public dialogue, bring people together so you know you're not alone. And then we, after that phase ended, we got together with people who were involved in that movement and other social justice movements and said, what do we do now to kind of build this movement to a bigger national movement that really can have some impact on issues? And so after that kind of process of listening to each other, we came up with Popular Resistance. And it's a movement that covers the social, economic, and environmental justice and tries to push those issues forward. In addition to covering the movement, we also participate. And so we run various campaigns. We've just finished a net neutrality campaign, which we successfully completed and won. And we are involved in a campaign to stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership and fast track for other global corporate trade agreements, these rigged agreements they falsely call free trade, which is not free at all. And we're also involved in lots of climate issues. We have a project called We Are Cove Point, which is trying to stop an export terminal for fracked gas. Very important issue. And it would affect all the fracking on the East Coast. If we stop that at Cove Point, we can really impact fracking in the whole Marcellus Shale. So as we take on issues with the idea of bringing together groups, like net neutrality, for example. Everyone's affected. We need the internet to do our work. And so everybody got involved. We pulled people in from various issues. Same with the rigged trade agreements. They will affect every aspect of our lives. And so food and water, GMOs, banking, healthcare, energy, everything is impacted by it. So it brings people together and creates this solidarity of a mass movement. Because that's what we think. Our philosophy, you need a mass movement to win. And you proceed on two tracks, challenging what's going wrong in the country, and building what you want to see happen. So it's stop the machine, create a new world. And that's what we've been pursuing as a strategy and pulling this mass movement together with lots of other people. We don't do it alone, obviously.
It's interesting that you bring up Cove Point, because here in Washington State, we've got multiple terminals they were trying to build.
A
bunch of them have been, due to public resistance, projects have been stopped for now.
Right.
So, and it reminds me, again, of your of connecting all these things together of when we were fighting the basically billion-dollar stadiums here in town.
Oh, geez.
That, again, was happening across the country, but you didn't know that based on media coverage.
Right.
And if we had only known that, imagine how things could have changed.
That's true in every issue. We just did education recently.
Right. But, you know, an interesting thing about Cove Point, one other reason that it's so important is that they're actually building this refinery and export terminal in a residential neighborhood. This has never been done before. Imagine this huge refinery And literally the entrance to the plant, there are houses across the street. There's a recreational field along the side of the property where this plant is.
There are daycare centers and schools, and it's crazy, right across the street.
And it's on a peninsula, so if there's an explosion, people, hundreds of families will have to drive towards the terminal to escape. But
and so it's only 3 miles from a nuclear power plant on top of that.
Right. And and the company that owns it lied to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
That's amazing.
About it. They listed the population of a center that was 16 miles north and population of a center that was 8 miles south. And they left out 45,000 in between that. And the federal agency is not doing its job. So we've actually been involved in Beyond Extreme Energy, which is a coalition focused on the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. We shut it down for a week in November. We're going back in May to bring more people, hopefully, and shut it down again and try to push them to stop approving all of this oil and gas infrastructure.
Most people never heard of FERC, just like most people never heard of TPP a few years ago.
Right.
Most people never heard of FERC now. And FERC is the agency that approves all of the oil and gas infrastructure. And they do it very quietly, totally in working with the industry. And
they're financed by the industry. It's the only federal agency that's financed by the industry
regulate. Yeah. Is that bizarre? And they're proving thousands and thousands of miles of pipelines, these export terminals that you mentioned. They're still fighting some
of
Oregon as well, compressor stations. You know, so at a time when with science shows we should be stopping building oil and gas infrastructure and moving toward clean sustainable energy sources, they're approving mass amounts of pipelines and other infrastructure. So it's an insane thing. And we are focused on Cove Point. We also have a coast-to-coast call where we're having people who are working on the West Coast as well as East Coast on these same issues that we've organized. We're, at the BXE, the Beyond Extreme Energy Project. We just had a call last week with about 80 different local communities that are dealing
frontline groups
that are dealing
across
with
the country
that have been FERC'd. these are all unifying issues. And energy is at such a major part of our economy that we got energy wrong, we're not going to get most things right. So we got to get energy right.
Talk a bit about more of your work with and against the TPP, because this last week there's just a big release via WikiLeaks.
Thank you, WikiLeaks.
Yeah. Yes, at least we can rely on them to let us know what's going on in our country sometimes.
Crazy way to run a democracy. Leaks is where you get the information from a classified document.
So we've been involved in this struggle for more than 3 years, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership is an international agreement that's being negotiated between 12 different countries, Pacific Rim countries, so Canada, the U.S., Mexico, Peru and Chile, New Zealand, Australia, Japan, and then Brunei, Singapore, Vietnam, Malaysia. And so it's been negotiated for the last 5 years. And while they kind of call it a trade agreement, of the 29 chapters, only about 4 or 5 of them are about trade. And the rest of the chapters are about things that multinational corporations have wanted from Congress, but they haven't been able to get in through the front door. So they're putting them into this agreement, and then for the first time in the history of the U.S., they classified the text of the agreement. So whereas in the past we were able to see what they were negotiating, now not only are we shut out, but our members of Congress have very restricted access. They have to go through a very extended process to apply to see summaries of the text. They can go into a room if they're approved. Very few have done that. And it's read and retain only. They can't bring staff. They can't bring a camera. They can't bring notepaper and pen. And
phone. I mean, they can't do anything that's going to allow them to actually show people what's in the agreement.
And then when they come out, they can't talk about the specifics.
They're actually threatened with prosecution. Yeah. If you tell your constituents what's in this agreement, you can be prosecuted.
Right. The trade representative recently met behind closed doors with the House Democrats and told them if they leaked anything that was told to them in that meeting, they would be prosecuted. So,
But 600 corporations are advising the Obama administration on the details, and they see it live on their laptop, and they can make suggestions, take out that comma, take out that phrase, add this paragraph, take out that paragraph. Mm-hmm. So this has been 5 years, or 6 years now almost, of secret negotiations with some of the top corporate lawyers in the country helping to write it. And what the issue now is fast track.
Right, right. And these are corporations like Halliburton and Monsanto.
All the ones
Walmart.
We love. All the ones we love.
So they say they're getting close to the final, the end of the negotiations, and the United States has been very aggressive. We know thanks to leaks from WikiLeaks, we've seen some of the negotiating positions in the U.S. is very aggressively pushing for greater corporate power.
It's the most corporate of all. If you look at if you make a football field and you look at the 90-yard line, that's where the U.S. is as far as corporate power goes. Australia, which is very corporate, is about 60. And that's probably the closest to us. Everyone else is further to the left of the football field. So we are way out there on corporate power. Obama is pushing a corporate agenda like no other country in the world.
Yeah, do you want to just talk about what the recent chapter that was leaked was, the ISDS chapter, investor-state dispute settlement?
The investor chapter is critical. It is really what defines the agreement, and it's essential for the corporations, because what it does is begins to create a whole new area of corporate law that's designed for corporate power. And the centerpiece of that is these trade tribunals, which will give the corporations the power to sue governments if there is a public interest action, you know, raising wages for workers, stopping fracking, and anything that's done to protect the public or the environment can be sued, and they get to sue for the profits they expected to get, not their, you know, any real investment to return, but what they expect their profit was going to be. And so they get sued before these special trade tribunals, where there are three judges. Almost always there'll be corporate lawyers on leave from their corporate job, being lawyers, then going back to their corporate job. And this has nothing to do with the domestic law of the country. The U.S. law would have nothing to do with that.
It supersedes domestic law.
Supersedes domestic law. Yeah. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court could not overturn a corporate trade tribunal decision. And the interesting thing about the leak was that something we already knew, but now it's out in the public, is that this is not supposed to be known by the public until 4 years after the TPP is enacted, or 4 years after they stop negotiating it. So it's a super secret. It's not just a secret while they're negotiating it, while they're passing it. It's a secret 4 years after they pass it. We're not allowed to know what's in it. It's just a bizarre – it's like a dystopian science fiction novel to look at this corporate power grab. It's just incredible that they have the hubris to do this and think they can get away with it.
So fast track is the key. That was what that is a piece of legislation that Congress would have to pass. The president has asked for it. It would allow the president to sign this agreement before it goes to Congress. Then they would have very limited time to read the contents of this very technical language, then very limited debate, no amendments, and just an up or down vote. Fast track is something that's been used in the past to pass the kinds of agreements that wouldn't get through if there was a true, transparent, and democratic process. So NAFTA, WTO were used, you know, were passed with fast track. But we have over 100 trade agreements that have been passed without fast track,
right.
You know, smaller ones that actually did have review. So it's not necessary to pass them trade agreements. It's necessary if you're trying to sneak something through that the public wouldn't approve of. So we've been very involved in trying to stop that fast track legislation.
The focus is on right now on Senator Wyden in the Senate, because he's the ranking Democrat on the Finance Committee. He's from Oregon. Well, he has a $10 million house in New York City. He doesn't like us protesting it. And then the House is the key, too. And you do have some members in the Washington State who are undecided, so you really should be contacting your members. 202-224-3121. 202-224-3121 is the Congress number. Just ask for your representative and push them on fast track. You want them to oppose fast track of any sort. There's no fast track for these agreements that have been negotiated for 5 years in secret that shouldn't be allowed.
Well, actually, in a week coming up, April 1st to April 8th, you can go to stopfasttrack.com, and that will actually be driving phone calls towards Senator Wyden and the Senate Finance Committee, because we expect them, when they come back from their break on April 13th, to probably introduce fast track legislation then. So that's a key time before they come back to pressure them.
We want to produce tens of thousands of phone calls.
Yeah.
We did that a year ago in January when they tried this again. We had 60,000 phone calls and hundreds of thousands of emails sent to Congress, so stopfasttrack.com can become a wave, an avalanche of citizens saying no to fast track. I think we can stop them.
And traditionally, phone calls carry more weight.
Much more weight than emails.
Right, than an email. Right.
Right. And our own Senator Cantwell and Murray have both expressed support for TPP, which I find really unbelievable.
Well, you know, the thing about these West Coast senators is they see themselves having an export economy, that Asia is a great export source. But what's important that they don't put into the equation is two things. One, we already have trade agreements with most of these countries, so you don't need this trade agreement. You already have an export opportunity with Asia, so this agreement doesn't do that. And the second thing is, this is going to actually undermine the economies in Washington, Oregon. It's going to be, you'll be competing with, you know, Vietnam, where the minimum wage is under 50 cents an hour. You're going to have allow these corporations to come in and say, you know, you can't raise the wages here. You know, you can't stop fracking here. You're giving them power over our economy. So it's a bizarre thing to support. I understand without thinking about it why they would support it, because more trade is good. But the reality is you already have trade. It doesn't. You don't need this. This is just a corporate power grab.
But Seattle is standing up.
And that's right.
Across the country.
And the country and federal government's noting it.
Yeah. Across the country, towns and counties have been passing resolutions called TPP free zones, saying that if you pass this law in secret and it undermines our ability to protect ourselves, we are not going to obey.
And expressing opposition to fast track.
Very clearly.
Seattle
is voting, the Seattle City Council, on Monday at 2 o'clock.
We'll be there.
Yeah, so we're excited, and we hope that it passes here in Seattle.
And we know the U.S. Trade Rep and the White House have noticed Seattle. So Congratulations to the City Council for standing up. Cities make a difference, and Seattle is a very powerful city.
Bellingham City Council.
Yes, they did.
Passed unanimously this last week against TPP.
They were under the radar. Now, I think that may have put the White House and Trade Rep on notice, because they're not under the radar on Seattle. Seattle, they're aware of what you're doing.
And again, just as an example, these natural gas and oil export facilities that are being pushed across the country, obviously in the coastal regions especially, that would be a type of project that under the TPP, these corporations, if the citizens shut these down, these corporations could then sue the U.S. government for their expected money they would have made at facility had it been built.
That's right. And the Atlantic, when they're negotiating, very much focuses on export of gas to Europe. That's a big aspect of the Atlantic version of the TPP. We call it TAFTA, just to remind people of NAFTA. And so that they're pushing, and that would be a big push to, you know, more export of gas and more excavation of gas in the United States. It'll just be a terrible thing for the whole issue of climate change and the local environments where these shales exist.
Yeah, so imagine if Seattle was sued for hundreds of millions or $1 billion. You know, how could you afford that? The citizens can't afford that. So they would have to give in to these corporations.
And no court review.
Right, tribunal
of
corporate lawyers.
Where you have no voice.
It sounds great. I don't know why I'm going to run behind this.
Good morning.
What's the problem? So talk a little bit about, Margaret, you are one of the speakers tonight at the event put on the annual public meeting of Physicians for a National Health Plan Western Washington Chapter. It's happening 7 o'clock tonight at Kane Hall. And you've been pushing single-payer health care for a long time. So where are we on that road to single-payer health care?
I'm very excited to be back. I spoke back in 2010, and it was great, and it's great to be here in Seattle again. We had in 2010, we passed a federal law, the Affordable Care Act, and it didn't solve the problem. People, I think, more people are starting to see that now that we're 5 years out, and they see that while more people have health insurance, they're still struggling to see the health professionals that they need to see. They're still struggling to pay their medical bills. Out-of-pocket costs are still high. And so it seems like we're really seeing more enthusiasm for people to support a single-payer. You know, it's basically a universal, publicly financed healthcare system that's about health. You know, surprise, instead of profit for these large medical corporations. And Western Washington Washington State is one of the states that has a healthcare as a human right campaign. And so people here have been organizing, which is fantastic. And we have one in Maryland, Vermont has one, Pennsylvania, Maine, Oregon. So we do see folks that are organizing and educating and pushing for both at the state level and the national level. There is a piece of legislation that Congressman John Conyers has reintroduced this Congress. It's called the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, H.R. 676. And it's one of these fronts of struggles that is really critical. If we could solve the healthcare crisis with a single-payer system, it would boost our economy. It would relieve a lot of families from the suffering that they're going through and medical debt. So
we're doing more to shrink the wealth divide than almost anything we could do in one step.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, what's interesting about this time now is that for last few years, you really couldn't criticize the ACA or Obamacare, whatever you want to call it. And now people are seeing it's not all it was cracked up to be. You know, you get these headlines in the paper about X millions more now have insurance. But the sub-headlines are much more important because they have insurance that's useless. They can't afford health care. The payouts from, you know, co-pays and out-of-pocket costs that come with the insurance is just going to make it so people don't get health care they need. It's privatized the insurance, the health care system even more, and it's put the burden more on the consumers to pay the costs rather than on the insurance companies. And they've got these terrible narrow networks. What I mean by that is they don't cover a lot of the major hospitals. And so if you have a diabetes problem or a cancer problem, you have to go to a major hospital, it's most likely not going to be covered in your insurance. And so what that means, you pay for it. So it's this fraudulent headline that you're covered. People are starting to catch on to the game here of what really happened. And so now people want a real solution. So that's got to keep growing because you still don't have a lot of discussion about the realities of the ACA. And so it starts with education. So that's why Market's here, you know, to help to bring those kinds of issues to the forefront so people start to get realize that they've been, you know, bamboozled by the largest.
The greatest insurance scam in history.
The greatest insurance scam in history. That was one of the articles we wrote about it. And we've been bamboozled into thinking we're getting something when we really actually have things taken away from us and we're paying for it.
This is another one of those issues that really, for me, it's not just about access to health care. Health care is really part of the broader struggle for social and economic justice, because if we just give people access to health care and we don't address education and, you know, having a job with a living wage or a house that you can afford to live in or being able to get healthy food or breathe clean air, drink clean water, if we don't address all these issues, we're not going to solve the health crisis completely in this country. And so, and in addition to that, we're not going to get a single-payer health system if just the people who care about a single-payer health system are out there fighting. We all need to come into this fight and recognize that it affects every one of us and that if we work together, we can win. We're actually starting to see some wins on other issues that were, you know, people didn't think could actually happen. So, you know, the net neutrality battle that we just fought, that was a surprising win to a lot of people.
Right. And although in some ways, I mean, it had built on the energy that came out of the fight against SOPA.
No question it did. No question. And, you know, that may be something undermined by the TPP, the SOPA.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, no question it did. I think what's really interesting about that issue, SOPA and net neutrality, is it's showing a new type of political power that didn't exist, which is the internet community, the people of the internet. If they get educated about something, they can really act, and they can create those kinds of tidal waves of action that Congress can't ignore, as corrupt as it is.
Right.
It becomes very clear that their careers are on the line if they go the wrong direction. And I think that's affecting Wyden right now in Oregon, I think, over the fast-track issue.
He's getting thousands of phone calls.
Phone calls
dozens.
And people are following him everywhere. Wherever he goes, he's being harassed about it. It's like a major. We did a protest at a fundraiser of his this week, and he heard about it and had to move the fundraiser to a secret location. You know, it's just like, what is that? That's what transparency is, Ron? You're going to hide that you're taking money from the people who are going to benefit from Fast Track? I mean, come on, let's get it out in the open and deal with it. Let's not hide these things from the public. And so net neutrality was a great victory, because when we started this campaign 11 months ago, we were told this is not an option to have the internet as a common carrier where there's no discrimination. That's what net neutrality is. Everyone has equal access. Money doesn't buy you a better place. And so we were told that's not on the table, not politically possible, will not be discussed. 8 days, that came out in a leak in the Wall Street Journal. They were going this tiered internet where they're going to pay more, you get faster websites. And so we decided 8 days before the meeting to occupy the FCC put an encampment. Mark and I went out there the first night by ourselves. We thought, what are we doing out here? The two of us sleeping in front of the FCC. We don't like to camp out. I don't like to camp out to begin with, especially not in the city. And then within a week, we had 20 tents, and people were out there. And three out of five of the commissioners came down to talk to us, including Tom Wheeler, the chairman. And by the time he announced his rulemaking process, he included, of course, he continued his tiered internet proposal. But he said, I also want to hear about reclassification to make it a common carrier where there's no discrimination. You wanted to hear about that.
But another key piece of that is that while we were out there occupying, really just to bring visibility. And the FCC had never been really protested before, so this was foreign to them. And a lot of the employees came out and said thank you for being here because they believed in net neutrality. But the internet community rose up.
They crashed
their phones. They crashed their servers. They were calling in, emailing in. And so the FCC was just really barraged with this. And then after the chairman put that proposal on the table, we had a record number of public comments. Almost 4 million people commented. And what's really interesting is that in the first round, 99% of the comments were for reclassifying. And it was only that 1% that wanted to hang on to a discriminatory internet. So,
yeah, it's an amazing victory. Then what became impossible became inevitable. It took constant pressure, though. I mean, this is like we had to blockade the chairman's driveway one morning so he couldn't go to work. I mean, so it was like it was a constant pressure process from a variety of sources. And it was a really interesting coalition of radicals and reformers, Democrats and independents. And
tech companies. Small business.
A really interesting coalition made that happen. And so it's a real sign, again, of coming together, solidarity, and we can have power. And that's really important for people to learn.
So only a few minutes left. So talk about the importance of, obviously, the internet and net neutrality are a key tool towards changing things, but balancing that with people that are spending way more time in front of their computers and not being out in the streets like you two consistently are.
So, yeah, I mean, it isn't sufficient. It's you know, there are a variety of tactics that people can use. And certainly that's important, but to email and phone call and things like that into your members of Congress or whatever you need to, you know, target to get the social change that we need. But one of the things that's exciting that we've seen over the last 5 years, when we came into this struggle of organizing the Occupy in Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., and then Popular Resistance, what we saw is that the traditional tools that we've used, you know, contacting our member of Congress or, you know, writing letters to them aren't sufficient, that we live in this very corrupt political system. And so we have to build this culture of resistance and stand up and just really say to them, no, we're going to protest you and we're going to follow you. We're going to hound you. That's how New York won the fracking ban. They made Governor Cuomo's life miserable everywhere he went. And so this culture of resistance is growing, and that means getting out in the street, and it means being visible.
And I want to applaud Seattle. You know, we have the $15 an hour celebration this afternoon.
At 1 o'clock?
At 1 o'clock. I'll be speaking out. I haven't spoken in Seattle since the Hemp Fest. I used to speak at Hemp Fest all the time before it was legal. I haven't been here since it was legal, but I've held a series of Hemp Fests before the legal era. And so I'm glad to come back and be part of that this afternoon. But that's an example. And when you have those kind of victories, it's important to notice them and realize that you have power and you can make a difference. And because we're so told we have no power. The reality is we do have power. And if we use it, we can make you can make Seattle into a – you have everything needed in Seattle, from the grassroots mobilizations to some good people on the city council to a mayor and to, you know, a lot of things you can really build on here to make this a really – amazing city and a model for the rest of the country. So I hope that this Fight for 15 is just a first step.
So we've got that event happening today at 1 o'clock at Seattle Central.
I'm glad you know where it is.
College.
I didn't know
it used
where
to be called
it.
Community College. I don't know, jazz on the removal of that. And then tonight, Margaret, you'll be speaking at the annual public meeting of Physicians for a National Health Plan, Western Washington Chapter, 7 o'clock at Kane Hall.
Doors open at 6.
University of Washington campus, free event. And then Monday at the Seattle City Council.
That'll be fun.
2 o'clock.
2 o'clock.
We'll show the White House
the
can't
TPP.
Push Seattle around.
Yeah. And then finally, how do people find out more about your organization?
Well, we encourage them to go to popularresistance.org. You can sign up for our weekly newsletter, or we have a daily digest where you get an email each morning with a photo and a summary of each story that we posted the day before. We post about 12 to 20 stories a day. So if you want to keep up with what's not being covered in the commercial media and see how much great things, you know, how many great things are going on across the country, as well as we provide a lot of reports that are done on various issues so that you can get the facts about what's going on.
It's much better to start the day with the Popular Resistance newsletter than it is with the newspaper. You're actually seeing that there are people working to change the world for the better, and you're not alone in trying to do that. It really makes you more confident.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you both for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks
for
the time.
Thank you for inviting us.